What's up? It's your boys, Jordan and Abraham. He's a professional runner. He's your fast friend. I'm an MD, PhD student. I'm your smart friend. Most importantly, we are your friends who read One Piece. I haven't got to read any One Piece lately. If I were, I feel like I'd be looking forward to maybe what Vegapunk is going to be revealing in a couple chapters, getting ready to rub it in when Jordan is proven spectacularly wrong. But, you know, a couple more weeks. You just got to wait a couple more weeks. And then...
Bro, I'm getting scratchy, we'll get bro. I'm getting scratchy, man. Like, I'm starting to have marks all over my arms and my necks, man. I'm getting withdrawal, man. It's like you when you are on crack. But, you know, because I know you on crack, and every now and then you become sensible, and it's like you know, it's like Abraham. Like, I know you're going through a tough time. I'm learning what you're going through whenever you don't get the cracks from some of these bad theories you are spitting out here. Because right now, I haven't had any One Piece in 2 weeks, and I got, like, 2 more weeks of this. I don't know how I'm going to make it, bro.
You'll be all right. You'll be all right. Oda can get his rest. As long as we get to there. I think the worst thing that could happen is if Oda left us before the story ended and we it was always a little bit of doubt where, like, is this the ending that Oda had in mind? That would break. That would be just, yeah, that would break me. So, you know what, Oda, get your rest and just give us some good stuff.
Well, you know the you know how, like, there's a version of We Are that's sung by all the members of the cast? You seen that one?
Huh? I've seen it, yeah.
If you go and look at all the comments on the video, especially the Japanese one, it's all like, man, we've been so lucky that no one's died over 30 years of this show. Like, I sure hope no one dies before the show ends. It's like, dang.
Yep.
That's morbid, but we are lucky.
So, we want to throw you guys a little bit of a curve, Jordan. You wanted to talk about some animals for some reason. I still don't know why you wanted to talk about these animals in One Piece. Why don't you tell me what is it about these animals that you love so much? What do you want to talk about?
Yeah, man. Well, you know, I was feeling inspired after taking so much crap for my amusement at whatever the Elder Star who turned into a giant sandworm was, which was just, you know, it was hilarious. It was over the top. Yes, it had a giant mouth. Don't make it weird, dude.
I wouldn't describe the your feelings as amusement. I feel like, I don't know. You took this to a weird place.
But it's every time I've, like, reread different arcs of One Piece or different chapters, I'm really struck by how much the animals, especially in earlier parts of the series, stick out to me as adding a lot of, like, comedy to the series and just, like, how One Piece they feel, right? And to me, that's in part why I love the worm so much, is it's just so cartoonish. And man, don't be smirking with remarks with me talking about, like, the worm. No,
I'm not. Oh, go ahead.
But
go ahead.
You know, I think to me, part of the reason that I find that so funny is it feels like one of, like, quintessential Oda animals that do such a good job of, like, conveying the kind of, like, wackiness or emotion or just kind of, like, off-kilterness that we get in a lot of throughout the course of One Piece. And sometimes that can be in stories where they hit really hard emotionally, like Chow Chow, the mayor's dog, in whatever freaking village Buggy was terrorizing. I don't remember the name of it.
Orange Town.
That was Orange Town? I thought Orange Town was... Oh, that's Arlong Park. Yeah, in Orange Town. You know, Chow Chow just, like, in front of the house that's burning and that kind of being the final straw, and you're watching this dog bark furiously as the place it lives goes up in flames, you know, all the way to characters like Ryunosuke, the dragon that's drawn by Kanjuro, that is like just trying its hardest. And there's something about how Oda is able to convey how exactly hard it's trying that feels so cute and so hilarious and just like so uniquely One Piece before Robin eventually mourns its death. So, you know, I'm sort of curious, right? Like, what animal moments, I have a lot more that I can continue to talk about. I'm sort of curious, like, what animal moments have like stuck out to you over the course of reading the series? You know, what, yeah, let's start with that. Like, what animals has stuck out to you over the course of reading the series?
So the easy one is obviously Laboon, right? Like, that's, if Laboon is not the first one that comes to everyone's mind, then you're reading the wrong series.
Oh, come on, bro.
What? I'm sorry, you just are. If you didn't get the thriller bark and immediately the payoff that we got from that, right? Where you're just like, oh yeah, we meet this random animal, we befriend it. You don't really think much of Laboon. I didn't think much of Laboon when we first met him. And then like 200 chapters later, run into this skeleton and you're like, he's genuinely like, why do you even have a will to live? Like, all of your crewmates are dead. There's nothing for you to live for at this point. Well, you know, we left crewmate behind, and on the off chance that he's still waiting there for me, I have to get back there for him. And he says, you know, it's Laboon. And like, damn, this whale, and everyone's been trying to tell this whale, your friends abandoned you, but like, they're not coming back. And meanwhile, halfway across the world, this dude is not even letting death stop him from trying to reunite with his friends. He literally died, and he's like, that's not me, I'm not coming back.
Letting death.
Obviously, Laboon is goated. He's the number one animal. I think for me, after Laboon, it probably is I think it's Karu. Karu and the Supersonic Duck Squad. The squad is just had the badass name. But then Karu is also, it's kind of unfair because we spent so much time with him. But he was just like, you know, good comedic tension. And he had his like small like emotional moments, like when he's getting his ass beat by Mr. Five and stuff. So I love Karu. Lashes the camel on Alabasta also made me laugh a lot, where he like refused to let any of the men like ride on him, and then he's just like, right. He's like, I only carry ladies. I love Lashes was hilarious.
But these are all
who knows?
I want to talk about some of those, and then we can get, because there's some more that even that, you know, like that's what's so, is we have so many more that have that. There's so much to say, but like I love like one thing about it's like the moment with Laboon, I think, that does it for me. And I'm saying he's not my number one, but I think Karu is my number one, so we're close, right? Hey, come on! Hey, hold on, okay. Bro. That's your number two. Bro, kill me for a second. Well, I said you're looking at
the. I think it's ridiculous. That's ridiculous, but okay.
Bro, Karu. What I love about Laboon is like the moment I think where. Just like I think, like something about the way he's drawn with Oda too. It's like he's off kilter in his shape, right? Like he's got a funny shaped head, actually. And there's something about like his.
He's been banging it against the red line for 100 years.
Bro, all those whales have funny shaped heads. That's all I'm saying. And there's like something like there's something that feels so pure because of the way the character is drawn about. Watching him like actually scream out at the top of his lungs in sadness as everyone leaves, like when you're reading that flashback and when you're like just seeing him cry with the Straw Hats there. And that's also part of what in the initial time we're meeting him makes it feel so whole and so fun, when he actually gets the stupid old Luffy, like, ugly drawing of a straw hat, like, covering stars.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it just can, like, there's something about it that makes you, like, smile in a way that reading a lot of other series, like, I don't think I ever smiled like that reading Bleach, you know? Like, I don't think I ever smiled like that reading Naruto. And this is a series that had a lot of, like, amazing moments and a lot of sad moments. And, it, like, nothing that just, like, kind of, like, tugs at your soul in the way that Oda's animals. As for Karu, man, it's, like, there's just a lot of moments with Karu that I think we really sleep on. That when you go back and reread Alabasta, you're like, this animal is, like, freaking funny. You know, it's little moments like when I think he like got shot and he's like pretending to be, no, I'm thinking of Sherry anyway. I'm thinking, there is a moment where he like pretend it gets okay really fast when he like was dying for a second earlier. And I can't even remember exactly what the moment is, but like, you know, when they're in the desert and he's running and like drinking his water. And it's like this incredibly like serious, like I'm chugging water. But, like, the ability to, in such a ridiculous figure as Karu and the rest of Supersonic Duck Squadron, convey such a sense of, like, this is a duck that has a deep sense of seriousness and conviction and, like, loyalty to, like, the Straw Hats and Vivi is so incredible and, like, what makes the character feel awesome.
No, I agree. Karu's amazing. I don't want to forget about.
You ever notice at the end of Alabasta when they're all at the banquet too? I know you brought up Lashes. That's one of the funniest moments. Yeah. We're like, wait, what the heck are you doing here, Lashes? Like, he wasn't even like invited, and they're all accomplishing like the big thing with, you know, Usopp having all the, you know, freaking plates on his nose, and someone's just like, wait, Lashes, why are you here? And Karu's off on the other end of the table just like with his cheek stuffed.
I Alabasta was filled with those kinds of, like, we even the crab that, you know, carried them across the desert, there were a bunch of great animals in Alabasta. Yokozuna is the banana gators, the banana wani.
And when Luffy comes in, he's like, wow, those are weird bananas.
Yokozuna is probably, you know, close to the top of my list as well. Favorite animals. He's got a similar story to Lagoon almost, you know, where he's like, his friend is taken from him and he's trying to stop this sea train over and over from stealing his friend, you know? And I think he knows that Tom is gone and Frankie is gone and they're not coming back. But, like, Yokozuna is awesome.
This man out here choosing animals in the same way he chooses backstories, bro.
I genuinely think there's something wrong with you if Laboon is not your favorite animal in the series. Like, clinically, I think I might be able to diagnose you with something.
Bro, come on. Like to say Laboon has to be number one is, like, totally bonkers. Like,
it does.
Like, Karu is, Karu has that same conviction. Karu has more, like, yes, Laboon's story is beautiful and heartbreaking and heartwarming all at the same time. Karu is hilarious. Karu is he's a real one too, right? Like, he's an OG. Like, I'm with the crew. In a lot of his moments are also like deep moments are also played for hilarity. Like, there's definitely some moment where he also like holds up his arm with the X on it, and it's and there's just like something hysterical about watching this like ridiculous figure do it. But all of these little like cute moments where he's running and serious, where he's like pretending to be hurt but actually okay, or like when he's
hilarious,
like, letting himself,
I agree,
when he's getting hit by like Mr. Three or like Mr. The bombs guy, whatever he was all the time,
Mr. Five,
so much, like, there's so much beyond just the story to love about Karu?
I think the funniest animal moment for me were the Kung Fu dugong. I think the Kung Fu dugong, like the fact that, you know, Vivi's like, hey, you know, they get to the, I think, I can't remember where they got to, but Vivi's like, yeah, they're not going to let us pass until they acknowledge us as being stronger than them. Usopp looks at them, he's just like, I can go and take them and get his ass beat immediately. She's like, by the way, they're really, really strong. And then Luffy beats one of them, and they're all like, hey, I'm the new master!
Right.
Oh my god, that was hilarious. I love that moment.
And they show up again later in the arc too, right? Because I don't know if you guys are going to show up again, but they still show up. But you know, yeah, I think like the South Bird might have one of my favorite moments because it's again, it's like all the little like emotions that you get with the characters. And first of all, you're introduced to this bird who, you know, they're trying to make their way through, you know, whatever forest to find the bird. And it's just like calling all the curses of the bird, of the forest on them. And Chopper can speak to it. And I forget exactly what it says, but it's all these like incredibly condescending things. So you already kind of get this attitude that it like doesn't like them too much, right? Like it's a little bit uppity. It's a little bit like on its high horse. You know, it's aloof. It's not like Karu, you know, it's not gonna get along like that or like the Jugons in the end. And we go through this whole arc, we make it to Skypiea. You know, that's a different moment too. Whatever. Whether it's at the end when it almost gets left behind and they're going back and furiously flying to like catch up. I'm like, wait, you can't even see. I'm like waving my arms like crazy. Earth is going to catch up. They're like, don't leave me. Don't leave me. But really, especially the moment where Luffy, who we all know is kind of mischievous and silly, and he's like, look, it can't even turn the other way. Like it can't turn the other way. And he's like, no, I'm gonna turn north just to mess you guys up. And like this frame, the sequence of frames where you like where what Oda does is he's able to convey how like it's this bird who's trying to mess them up. It's a freaking toucan looking thing. And you can tell that it doesn't like them. And then you can tell that it's like looking the other way and getting really, really like you can kind of like watch its butthole tighten figuratively. Being like, ooh, I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. I don't like this. Until it turns back and it's just so ridiculous and hysterical. And it's so ridiculous and hysterical. Yeah. And it's so
wacky. I think Luffy called the bird stupid or something like that at that point too. Like, bad.
Bro, you're down bad.
No, you also, honestly, and then there was, I mean, I think that moment was hilarious, but I don't know if you remember the giant South Bird on Skypiea that tries to steal like Zoro's food. So like Zoro's hanging from his bag, his diet bag of food that the South Bird is trying to steal.
I do remember that.
And he's holding the bird down a little bit. He can't fly as well because of Zoro. And then the giant snake tries to, I think the giant snake on Skypiea is like trying to eat them or something like that. Maybe it was something else, but I think it was the giant snake. And Zoro's like, fly higher, fly higher, please. And you see the gears starting to click in the bird's brain. It's just like, no, I can just like drop this bag and abandon this guy. And it just, and Zoro also realizes it like a split second before the bird does this. And he's like, don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. Yeah. And the bird just yeets him off. That was a great moment, too.
The South Bird, that is a hilarious moment. That's definitely one of the ones up there. But how about Sherry, bro? The horse. First of all, I just love Long Ring Long Land. It's a totally underrated arc. I know anime only people are like, it's terrible, but in the manga, it's like a hysterical, I think, series. But Sherry.
Amazing animals. Maybe Backfight gets introduced.
Man, get out of here. The Navy back fight, that is not going to be a theme that we have to go through that same kind of fight again. Exactly. That Davy back fight was introduced, right?
Yes, was.
Yes, the Davy back fight we will not have another Davy back. The only Davy back fight that will happen in One Piece was introduced.
I don't know about that. Time will tell. Time will tell.
But yeah, you know, it's I think the moment that gets me with Sherry is, first of all, it's like, you know, do you watch John Oliver at all? Last Week Tonight?
I haven't seen the last season or two of it, but I've seen a decent amount of his episodes.
You know, so one of the recurring jokes he has is, you know, I don't like to swear, but you know, a horse that you would have sex with. He has a recurring joke about this. You know, I'm not going, it's a joke. It's a joke, right? He calls it an effable horse. He's like, that is an effable horse, you know? And I'm just saying that someone needs to send him an email with Sherry and One Piece. Bro, do you remember Sherry and One Piece?
Sherry an effable horse, Jordan? Sherry an effable horse?
Bro, it is.
I'm asking you.
I would not actually do that. I would not actually do that. But, he's created this horse that's, you know, first of all, just the whole premise of everything being super long is, hysterical. And it's like, oh, that's a dachshund and, a snow leopard. A snow leopard with sideways, which is weird. But, you know, when a Tonto comes out, he's like, oh, that's a horse. there's just something hysterical about watching this horse that has an incredibly pretty looking face and eyelashes and a ridiculous mane of hair. There's just something hysterical about it. And of course, then it gets shot. And then as soon as Tonto's oh, it's time to ride, it's better. And everyone's and Zoro's wow, you got better fast. Wait, are you telling me come on. Do you remember what Sherry looks like?
I do. I remember exactly what Sherry looks like.
Bro, tell me you wouldn't.
I wouldn't. I can tell you exactly that. I have no problem telling you that I wouldn't.
We do not endorse DC Allen podcast. I would not actually have sex.
I have some friends in Sodom and Gomorrah to introduce you to.
Bro,
not the One Piece ones either.
When one of their names is Sodom, you really cannot be introducing it like that.
Oh man!
And then
this obviously we can go on and on with the animals, but I want to move on to S class and F class because
smile real quick. The smile, bro. The smile. That's the last
okay.
one.
Okay. Last one. I got you.
I know that Zoe is not, Wano, sorry, is something that we hate on a lot, but I really do feel like that's one of its, saving graces will be strong to refer to the arc. But that's one of the things that really does shine to me is it feels like a place where Oda is able to make use of some of this hilarity that he brings to the series with a lot of these animals and implement them in just ridiculous and wacky ways that feel incredibly One Piece. Like when you have a gorilla smile where it's just the dude's hand and an actual gorilla comes out of his hand, the whole body, or the lion where it's basically just the wrestler belt. But I think in closing, I think that whenever I read One Piece, it sticks out as something that in a lot of ways highlights what is so great about the series. In things like when Ace dies and when you have Luffy just crying out at the top of his lungs. It's the exaggerated over-the-topness that's able to convey emotion beyond the normal range of human feelings that makes One Piece mm-hmm. feel special in those moments. It's the fact that you're in a series about a stretchy guy who even the Nika stuff, he's where he's like biting off freaking trees and turning him into home run bats and hitting guys, his eyes pop out of his head. And I think that the animal designs and the way these stories are used and the little things, whether it's how hard Ryunosuke is trying, whether it's Yokozuna determination, Laboon crying out in sadness and being happy when he's when he has the straw hat symbol on him, Karu and just everything about Karu because he's like the best animal in all of One Piece.
You're digging yourself into a hole. You're digging yourself into your own hole.
I said in summary, Karu is not the best animal in One Piece. But like I think it's a microcosm of what makes One Piece. One Piece and what gives it the quirk and lovability that it has beyond just the incredible story. And so I really wanted to spend some time while we just have 3 weeks to figure out what we're going to talk about highlighting that.
The strength of One Piece is in its world building, right? Not so much in its fight stuff. And all these animals are just a big part of that. They make the whole world feel more real and meaningful. But it is time to move on to S class and F class, because we could be talking about these animals for like another hour, and I don't know if anybody needs that.
I gotta go to bed, man.
Yeah, you wanna I have two theories today. How many do you have?
I have, you know, two. I could do two. I could do three. You know, we'll see. So I'm not gonna do three. Okay. So you know, but we'll see. If we're feeling good with your two, we can. But let's start with you. Let's rock with it.
Okay. I'm gonna start you off with the Emorge theory, and it's a Emorge theory that I think you're gonna agree with and be into.
I know what you're going to say, because I haven't watched the video, because I was like, I'll let Abraham describe it to me, but I was like, let me see if he tries to bring this again, saying it's not a Morris theory, to see what I say.
Oh, yeah. No, it's his latest video, right? About how Kizaru is going to sacrifice, end the Egghead arc by sacrificing himself to allow everyone to escape, essentially. So, premise of the video is that as Vegapunk is getting ready to deliver his message to the world government, if they're unable to find him, stop him as that timer is getting closer and closer, is going to become progressively more desperate in order to shut this message down. And the island-destroying weapon that they used to destroy Lelouchia Kingdom may be something that they decide to use to target Egghead. And more just point in the video is that while you can kind of see Kizaru, the emotional toll that everything he's done has had on him throughout this whole arc, right? At the end, specifically, what he points out is, you know how at the end of the last chapter, he's like, my wounds are too deep, let me rest. So on and so forth. Apparently, you would know this better than me, the Japanese translation of that phrase is akin to more mental or emotional exhaustion rather than actual physical exhaustion. I don't read Japanese, so I don't know any better. That's apparently how that phrase is translated. So his point is kind of that.
I haven't read the Roskins chapter. Yeah, I haven't read the Roskins chapter. Okay. But. Yeah. I'll say, at this point, I do like this prediction. I think...
Yeah, so his point is... Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, go.
Yeah, I do like the prediction. Like, I think it would be... Now, you know, obviously, Mort has had some pretty crazy predictions that have not come true in the past, but I think that it's really interesting, the idea of someone turning coat to let the Straw Hats escape. I think it gives us a really interesting narrative shift, both in terms of character progression for people who we've like seen as bad guys, and being able to, you know, I know I bring up a lot that we need to have interesting configurations of like good guys and bad guys through the rest of the series. And I think this is one way to begin with demonstrating that as we sort of like hightail it into the end game from this point. And I think that the idea that the Straw Hats would actually come out of this defeating all of the Elder Stars feels a bit, you know, that would feel like it was too much to me. So I'll give it an S-class theory. Yeah. The one thing that I don't like is I wish that, like, I actually thought Wano was the arc that we should have had this plot point where we had a guy we couldn't defeat. And it would have been really cool to have seen Kaido actually turncoat and be like, well, we've seen like this youthful Kaido who has dreams and is like smiling all the time and is the person that King wants to follow. And we've seen that person just become corrupted by, you know, he's become cynical over the course of the years. And I think it would have been better to have seen that if he helped them escape from the Marines after a long and kind of devastating battle. But I do really like the idea of this happening in Egghead. I think it would be interesting in my theory.
The last thing that he brings up is that if you look to an island like Enies Lobby, right, he points out the odd structure in Enies Lobby, the fact that I think it's that you have a random island that's in the middle of, surrounded by a bunch of empty space. It kind of looks like almost the weapon, like this kind of weapon maybe would have been used against Enies Lobby, but for some reason, part of the island was protected. Right? It's unlikely that a new island just popped. Not unlikely. I don't see how a new island could just pop up in its place. It would feel weird for the island to spontaneously have been formed like that. But his point is, maybe a previous awakened user of the light fruit was able to counteract like the lasers in this giant weapon and protect part of the island. And that's why Enies Lobby is also constantly bathed in sunlight. And so an analogous thing essentially would happen on Egghead Island. And we get our first Logia awakening and all that stuff.
That part's kind of whack to me, but, you know, that's okay. I'll just give you my next. See, I'm glad I stopped
you on the call. You already gave it an S.
I'm glad that I didn't let you get to that point before I gave an S last year because I want you feeling good. Okay, so you know I got a few theories for you. I'm gonna jump in with one that I think is interesting. It's that what if Hawkeye Mihawk is actually a defected Elder Star, Elder Planet, etc. One thing that is, there's a piece of evidence for this. Also, this isn't a theory that's like deeply evidenced in the series, but there's a lot of theorizing about where Mihawk comes from, is the use of the term insects to refer to a lot of different people through the One Piece world is often by the Elder Stars. And it's also something that Mihawk uses earlier in the series when we meet him, maybe during the East Blue Saga. I forget exactly.
Uh-huh.
What do you think? Mihawk, defected Elder Star, F-class or F-class?
The only connection between Mihawk and the Elder Stars is that he refers to people so far beneath him as insects, and I'm going to give him an F-class.
Bro.
Are you serious? Are you serious? How many times have we heard people, like, literally to Mihawk, it's like he says to Zoro, you're just frog in a well who doesn't realize how big, like, the world really is. Right? Like, Don Krieg and his crew, they are insects. Mihawk. Not, like, he's not devaluing human life in general. He's just saying, you guys don't mean anything to me. You're too weak.
I understand that, and I'm not sitting here saying that I think this theory is more likely than not, just to have it on the record, right? I'm not saying I think this theory is more likely than not. I think it presents a lot of interesting possibilities for the story, both because we have a lot of, like, we have no idea what motivates Mihawk, why is he just like riding around on a raft on his own? Where did he come from? How did he actually become so strong? And we know that in the sort of like elite world, you have these people who are like unbelievably strong. We've only just begun learning about the, you know, lost celestial dragons, like the celestial dragons who have like the Figarlands and all these different houses of people. And we know that some people have actually left their posts to go down to the world. I think it would be really interesting, although I'm not saying it's something that's highly evidenced, if that's part of what's motivating him, and that would give us some reason to tie him into the end game of the series, him having some kind of beef with these people whom he left.
Yeah. I've always thought of Mihawk and I guess his motivation in a similar way to I think of Saitama, I guess, in like One Punch Man, where his motivation was probably to be the strongest, greatest swordsman. And then once he achieved that, and once, you know, Shanks lost his arm and stuff, he says, you're not worth fighting once you lost your arm. I don't actually know how true that is. I feel like Shanks probably will give him a solid run. Once he achieved that goal of being the greatest swordsman, he kind of lost his ambition because he had already done whatever he wanted to. I don't think he has that kind of ambition. I don't think he's a character that's written in that way. That's why Buggy was... I think it's really, really notable. Buggy is the one who told all of the Cross Guild's crew going after the One Piece. Like, Croc didn't want to do that. Mihawk didn't want to do that. He calls them out. He's like, you know, you guys had dreams when you first started and you gave up on those dreams because you didn't think they were realistic, right? So I think this is a pretty clear F-class theory. I'm not going to lie. I think it's as the late, great Kobe Bryant would say, that's not just a stretch. That's a Bikrami yoga stretch.
Hey, once I have a good theory from you on where Mihawk came from, I'll let you start hating.
Okay.
What you got for me, number two?
Yeah. My second theory is from the Hidden Island. It's a larger theory about the importance of Elbaf in general. And it has a lot to do, as we all know, The giants are Jewish Vikings. That's what we established last week, right? Jewish Vikings.
Yeah, they're Jewish, exactly. Jewish Vikings.
Yeah. So, a large part of this theory revolves around understanding a lot of Norse mythology. And there's a creature in Norse mythology known as the Jormungandr. Is like the giant, it's essentially a giant serpent that wraps around the world. Right. And obviously, you know, in One Piece, Dory and Broggy, when we first meet them, they talk about, you know, the giant red serpent that wraps around the world. So I think we all believe that's a reference to the Red Line. But again, there's a creature in Norse mythology that to which that is related to. And the climax of Norse mythology all revolves around this giant endgame battle known as Ragnarok, where like all the gods have fallen and Jormungandr, I think, is defeated. And I don't know my mythology all that well because I just watched this video once, but essentially he goes on to say that, well, if we're keeping this analogy going, right? Maybe during Elbaf, just like during the final battle, Ragnarok is when the Jormungandr is defeated. This is when the Red Line will be destroyed. This is when the final war, aka Ragnarok, will kind of really start between, I guess in his case, the Straw Hat Pirates and the world government. And that he speculates that the three ancient weapons are going to be responsible for destroying the Red Line. So he says the Poseidon is, it extends all the way, obviously, to the seafloor. That bottom part of the Red Line, that'll be destroyed by the Sea Kings and Poseidon. Kind of like the middle part that's around sea level, that will be destroyed by Pluton, which we know of. and that we're going to find out about Uranus on Elbaf, and that Elbaf and that weapon could destroy the Red Line, I guess, from the skies. And so, he goes into a lot more in that video, but I guess that's the part of the video that I want to present to you today. What do you think about all that?
Man, I don't even know, man, because this is another Red Line Gets Destroyed theory, man. Like anyone who is listening to this podcast who has, like, followed One Piece theory for a while is just familiar with the Red Line Gets Destroyed theory. It's just not original. Like, to me, this is, like, maybe this is, was an S-class theory to bring up at some point. But it is at this point just unoriginal and not new content, and just feels like a recycling of a theory that we've heard many times for many years. So just in the merits of me not wanting to hear, and it's like the One Piece of the Party theory. If I hear another One Piece of the Party theory, now that one is way more F class just inherently, right? Like, this one is like an interesting theory I'm tired of hearing, and the One Piece of the Party theory is just a terrible theory. But no, whatever Greek mythology, whatever you want to mix in, okay, we're gonna destroy the Red Line. Maybe that will happen at the end of the series. I've heard that before.
Okay. All right, let me hear your second one.
All right, let me see. Aside from the couple that I have here, and again, this is another one. Don't be asking me for a lot of these details coming on, like, what it is. I'm just positing interesting ideas as theory, right? Bro, these are interesting.
That's part of your job. That is part of your job. You can't come out here with ideas and then be like, oh, that's interesting. Let me ask you a question about an assumption you're making with this idea. And you're like, I don't know the answer to that. Let me tell you something. That's not how this world works. That's not how life works.
Listen, man, we can come back to that. We can come back to that. Because, I think, let me put it, the way I judge S-class and F-class theories, there are kind of like a few pillars. There is evidence. And that is one that sometimes my theories can be light on. I will admit this. then there's interesting. Like, how interesting is that, and what would it imply for the plot? And then there's feasibility, which is not just like how evidence is it, but like, can I imagine this being the case? Even if there's no evidence for it, can I imagine it and then draw into that second pillar of what would this mean for the story and what would the implications be? And just kind of like the quick, cheap, and good triangle, you're not always going to get all three of those things. And so sometimes I might watch a 30-minute video and think, bringing this whole thing to S-class and F-class is a waste of my time. It's too detailed, and it's the whole thing. I watch this whole 30-minute video, and the whole thing is just too obviously an F-class theory and not interesting to me. But they brought up something that I think is interesting. And one of the things that I thought was interesting in a video that I watched, I think this is a Joy Boy Theories video, but there's a lot of questioning about what the infinite source of energy in One Piece comes from.
Okay.
And the suggestion is that it comes from some sort of slave labor on the moon. In some of the societies that we've seen, in some of the, whether it's the pirates we've seen or the sort of like underground society on the moon, but there's an infinite source of energy. But the source of it is slave labor.
Let me tell you something. I actually think. No, I put this. I think the reason why a lot of these moon races came, descended from the moon to the earth, was I don't know if this is canon or if this is just what people have speculated, but was that it was because there was a lack of resources and energy on the moon, right? They had kind of exhausted their resources, and so they went down to Earth essentially out of necessity, which would kind of be the opposite of this theory, right? But I love the idea in general, especially since we know Nell is on the moon. Enel is obviously, you know, the lightning fruit. You know, maybe his ability was able to, like, I don't know, power up some kind of ancient machine and enable something. I don't think this is I don't think this is something that is actually going to come true. This whole idea about slave labor on the moon and empowering some energy source. But I'll give it an S-class strictly because I think that Joy Boy, if this is a Joy Boy theory, is trying to connect, you know, these ancient moon races with this whole idea of energy sources and this other flame and all that. And I think that that's a unique take. So I'll give it an S-class, even though I don't actually think that this is something that's going to happen.
Man, you see how I didn't even provide more evidence on that one, but he just sees it, and he's like, it's an S-class, man. He just sees it. He sees the vision for it. And you know what it is? It's like, you just mentioned the moon. You just mentioned the moon, and this dude on S-class theory.
I can give you an S-class. If you want me to give you an F-class, I can do that. I have no problem. I was trying to be nice to you.
I appreciate you. Now, I think that's what we got for SF and F class. We don't have a chapter. There's no predictions. There's no awards. But, you know, one thing that people give awards for is plays. And I want to give Abraham the, you know, break a leg award because he was just in a play. Abraham, tell me about this play.
Musical. Musical, yeah. We did.
You were on stage.
I was on stage. It was for the school musical. So we did Little Shop of Horrors, which is a great show. If you've never seen it or heard of it, I highly recommend it. It's basically a show where this down on his luck character gets he finds this exotic plant. We actually find out later. This plant came from outer space. It's an alien, essentially. And it's a carnivorous plant that he realizes he needs to, like, feed blood to, and he gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually he has to start feeding people to this plant in order to keep it alive because it's bringing in so much business to, and him and the people he lives with are really, really poor. And eventually he has to come to grips with the fact that he's killed a couple of people and that this plant is now going to spread around the globe and so on and whatnot. So I played the role of Mr. Mushnick in the story. He's not the guy who found the plant. He's actually the main character's father figure. So he, like, adopts him, brings him in, but he kind of treats him like trash. Have you ever seen, like, Matilda before?
Years and years ago.
Okay, I was gonna say it's kind of like how Matilda's parents treat her, like the Wormwoods.
Like Harry Potter's parents, Matilda's parents.
Exactly. So it was my second time on stage.
Cinderella's parents.
I also,
Cinderella's parents.
That kind of character. He's kind of a mean guy. He takes advantage of Seymour. I do end up getting eaten in Act Two by the plant because I find out that he's been murdering people. And I'm like, hey, we got to turn you into the police now. And, you know, he tricks me into being eaten by this plant. It was a lot of fun. I was not a musical kind of theater kid before. I don't know if I would call myself that now, but I definitely wasn't that in high school or in college. I never... did anything like that beforehand. Then I got to watch you where I'm doing my MD PhD, and I was like, I don't want school, you know, to be my whole life. I wanna have hobbies and stuff that I'm actually getting meaning from outside of class. So, like, let me, and I want to try new things. So, they announced the school musical. Like, I can do this. I can try. They were doing Shrek that year. I auditioned. I got a role. I was pig number two, Shrek. And it actually was so much fun. Number two, because you know, there's the three little pigs in Shrek.
Damn, bro. Give us an oink. Give us an oink. Come on now.
Yeah, no. I had to do a bad German accent. That's what I was doing. Because the pigs have German accents. But no, it was actually like a really, really fun time. It was a fun time. I loved it. So I've been doing it basically every year since. A couple of our shows got canceled because of COVID and stuff. So this is only the second time I made it. But, you know, I had friends come out. They all loved it. I had a great time. I think you're going to like this. It's actually very much related to what we were talking about last week about being 30. So I was in the change room with, like, the leads had their own change room and the ensemble had their own change room, right? Mm. And so one of the girls in the show is playing music on her speaker in the change room, and she skips the song. She's like, this song is so overplayed in college. Like, and this song was came out like 3 years ago. No, I'm like, this is not that old of a song. And it's like, wait a second. I was like, Samantha, you know, when did you graduate college? And she's like, oh, I graduated in 2023, she told me. Because she, or maybe it was 2022. Because, yeah, let me say, and it, you know, it made sense when I thought about it for a second, because some of these people in this show, right, they graduated college and then they went straight to grad school. They didn't take like gap year or anything like that. Right. So she was like a first year PT student that had just graduated college. She was literally 22 or 23. And then some of the other people in the room, they're basically all women because there's only like three guys in the whole cast that auditioned. But they're all piping up and they're all like 22, 23, 24. And I was like,
dang, bro.
I think you guys were, I told them, I think you were in middle school when I started college. When did you start college? I was like, I started in 2012. And she's like, I was 11. I'm like, God, really? Yeah, they're so young. I couldn't believe it. Like, you know? And they were shocked too, because they thought I was like 23, 24. They thought I was their age.
Right.
And the whole time,
you're hanging out with 23-year-olds. Oh, we're the same age, right? Like, no.
not even close. Yeah. I never thought about how young they were, how old they were. Right. This is not something you really think about unless it comes up. I was like, dang. When you put it in that perspective where I was like, y'all were in middle school and I was in college. It just hit me. I was like, I really am the old man in the room.
Yeah, dude. Yeah. For like, it's like I said, man, like my roommate who's 23, like he thought Mariah Carey was a one hit wonder for All I Want for Christmas. I said, bro, go to the karaoke bar and look and see how many hits Mariah Carey has on. I guarantee you. He was talking about, so I was like, oh, I was talking about how one of my go-to karaoke songs, we weren't at, you know, before my birthday, is We Belong Together, you know, I didn't know nothing, I was stupid, and he's like, and I'm like, We Belong Together, oh, I know that song, and I started saying, he's like, what, Mariah Carey, he's singing some other song, he said, what, she has other songs? That's crazy, and I'm like, I look at you as an adult. Like, I look at you as an adult, and you stand up. Yeah. But Abraham, can you give us just a little bit of acting? Can you give us just a little bit of acting? Come on, man. Maybe a little bit of singing, man. Give us. Come on, man.
I don't know. I'm retired.
Come on, man. I know you got a mind. You're not retired, man. You do it every year. You're going to do it again next year. Okay, just
speak. Well, I'm on hiatus. I'm on a sabbatical.
Bro, just speak in a German accent, man.
I can't subject the good German people to that. Who knows? We might get listeners in Germany one day.
Man, we got listeners in Belgium. Shout out, listeners.
Exactly.
Belgium, I love you.
I'm trying to disrespect the German people like that.
Well, speaking of disrespect, man, let's get into our next topic. Skip Bayless, speaking of disrespect, has long told stories about his high school basketball career, which may or may not have been embellished and may or may not have led to Jalen Rose being banned from First Take while Bayless was still hosting. Bayless.
Water Pistol Pete Jr. That line, quoted.
Classic. Now, Bayless, who now hosts some of FS1's Undisputed, showed off some of his basketball prowess Wednesday with a video he posted on X. He has announced that he will be having a three-point contest against former NFL MVP and Undisputed co-host Cam Newton. He's on Undisputed? That's crazy. I didn't even know that. With more details.
I didn't know that until, yeah.
I copied and pasted from Awful Announcing, so he must be there sometimes. With more details to come Thursday on the Skip Bayless Show, that's today when we're recording this. Dan Lebatard, in another story, recently said, quote, "We're watching the death of Skip Bayless. He's been one," unquote. "He's been one of the godfathers of the current sports debate genre, but after breaking with Shannon Sharp, I'm pretty sure Nightcap had more live viewers than Undisputed on Super Bowl week, even though it's on at midnight. And this sure seems like an attention grab for Skip." So, Abraham, what do you want to see happen in this three-point shooting contest between Skip and Cam?
So, first of all, did you watch the video that he put out? You watched the video?
I did watch the video.
You see how edited it was? There's no, like, continuous shots of him putting up, like, 10 shots in a row. It's all, like,
one shot.
Make it. He made it, and then cuts to like the next shot. So you know, he was throwing up air bricks. Like it was a brick city.
But like, why would you do something so transparent? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, if you really are why would you do something so transparently obvious and like it's so obviously edited? You know.
I mean, if you can't make 5 shots in a row, then like, are you gonna? Yeah. Unless you want to put out videos, if you want to put out videos of the misses, you can. But other than that, there's no way, right? And also, I know you don't play ball like that, but that form was crazy. His shooting form was. It was like he had a. Like, you know, those old, like, catapults, you kind of have to, like, lock and load or whatever. Like you have to set it. And then that was basically what he was doing. I was like, this guy. I mean, he's old, you know? So, and he might end up being a better shooter than someone like me. You know, that's not saying much.
But I'm not the one. 73 either way, I'd say he's doing pretty good for himself. But I think it's been really interesting watching Skip. You know, like I've been watching Skip now for like a scary number of years, right? Like probably almost 20 years, over 15 for sure. Like since, you know, I used to put him on, I was one of the people watching that original
First Take
stuff. Yeah, exactly, right.
Yeah.
You know, when it used to just be like a variety show with a tiny bit of debate. And like, I remember the first episodes that happened when they like initially started doing the full debate format, when they started then having all the athletes call in to have the athletes versus journalists who can say what debate. And so it's been really, like, there's something really fascinating to me about watching one of the godfathers of this genre who's managed to stay relevant for deeply relevant for an unbelievably long amount of time for a dude of his age, really find himself now sort of like scratching and clawing to matter anymore. And to me, a lot of it feels like how much Shannon began to outshine him specifically on that show. And I'll say, right, like, I rock with Shannon. He went on The Herd one time. I used to listen to The Herd. And it was, what, I don't know if you remember, there's a game in maybe like 2006, probably 2015, where Eli Manning told Rashad Jennings not to score in the end zone. It was like one of the last plays of the game. He told him not to score. The game ended up going to overtime and they lost to the Cowboys. And I think Shannon was like, what? He told him not to score. He said, well, he should be dying $5 million. And I was just like dying laughing at him on The Herd. And so as soon as he was announced as the co-host for Undisputed, I was in. I liked Skip and I liked Shannon and I was down to watch it.
For sure. I actually heard of him because he made some First Take appearances before that. It was during the 2016 finals with when the Cavs came back against the Warriors. Shannon made a couple First Take appearances and he was killing it. I was like, I like this guy. He's funny. I never heard of him before because I didn't watch football in the like 90s. And then I Googled it. I was like, holy shit, this guy's a Hall of Fame tight end. And okay. So yeah, I agree. When they announced the pairing, I also thought it was going to be amazing. It was.
So it was, and I think that so much of what happened is, you know, it feels like Skip didn't appreciate, you know, the thing that worked so well with Shannon is part of why I think Nightcaps works so well is like Shannon's a great guy in contrast to someone who's saying ridiculous stuff because he's hilarious. He'll like play off of it. He knows what he's talking about. And, like, he'll call you on it, and you get to keep going, you know, because it's fun banter. And obviously Ocho comes at it from an angle where it's, like, more positive, ridiculous stuff, like trying to say Zach Wilson is going to be a really good NFL quarterback. This is obviously insane. And with Skip, it's, you know, the kind of stuff that Skip is known for, just, like, generally being a troll of everyone in the sports world. But it sort of reached a point where Shannon became the bigger personality and what he was doing and providing for that show was actually part of what was helping Skip. Like it was almost like we were there to watch Shannon and Skip was the one giving us the impetus to hear Shannon say hilarious things.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of sad to me, obviously, as he made the choice to let Shannon go from Undisputed, to watch him just like kind of become an old guy who's fading off into the sunset.
I wouldn't say it's sad to me. Like I've never actually found, I think the early days of Skip Bayless, I thought were very entertaining. I thought up until, I think I stopped finding him entertaining after he left First Take. I don't think I ever thought, there were moments where I thought he was funny, but I don't ever think I tuned into Undisputed to listen to Skip.
I'm not saying I loved him, but I recognized what he provided to this space.
Sure. I get it's true that, you know, he shaped the industry, right? And the industry wouldn't exist the way it does nowadays without him. But I don't want to judge this guy on a personal level because I don't know him, obviously, at a personal level. But he says and does things that, particularly to athletes, that are so out of touch. You know, from the Damar Hamlin stuff, from you know, how he treated Shannon at the end of his days, from you know how he's talked to someone like Coach, like Eric Mangini. I remember him, like, you know, mocking him for getting fired a couple of times when he was back on First Take, you know, to how he would talk about Troy Aikman and speculating that he was gay and all this other stuff, and how he would, or how he talks about like LeBron, right? And, or Chris Bosh. I think the moment that really got to me was like Chris Bosh came on his show to be like, hey, I know it's your job to criticize me. If you don't think I'm playing well, feel free to criticize me however much you want, but don't make fun of my family name, because he was calling him Bosh Spice, you know, likening him to like a Spice Girl. And he literally came out to his show, man to man, professionally, and was like, please don't make fun of my family name. You can criticize me without doing that. And Skip was like, if you play better, I won't. That was basically his answer. So So I don't feel bad for him. I really don't feel bad for him at all. He's been, I think, extremely unprofessional to a lot of athletes and just rude and way too proud his whole.
It's not even saying that I feel bad for Skip, right? Like, I had a whole thing where I thought a reporter wrote a piece to me that was unfair, and I still don't like the dude. I had to text him for a different thing, and I was like, man, I don't want to text this dude. I said, I told my other buddy, I said, you can text him because we're doing this together.
But imagine if he called you Jordan Woman instead of, like, Jordan Man. If he said Jordan Woman, right? Like,
Right. And I think that what felt to me as being particularly, like, what to me feels sad about it is just the, like, it's just the end of something, right? And it's the end of, like, this dude who, like, whether or not you like what Skip had to say as consumers of this brand of sports media, like, this dude has given me a lot of podcast hours that are not just listening to him, but are listening to other people who are doing the same kinds of things in the industry that he is basically the godfather of. And so that's something that, you know, whatever like you feel about Skip, he's obviously just like largely a douche to a lot of people, at least in his public professional persona. But it's sad to see the era end. And nonetheless, I will still be rooting for Cam Newton against him. But there's a part of me that kind of wants to see the chaos of, oh my God, if Skip actually wins this, like, what the heck?
That would be crazy. I'll tell you what I want to see real quick before we sign off. Google James Harden challenging Stephen A. Put up some 3-point shots. I don't know if you have you ever seen that video before?
No.
So James Harden ran up. He ran up on Stephen A. Before a Houston Rockets game once, and he's like, "You've been talking a lot of shit. I want to see you put up some shots right now. Back it up. Back up your back up what you've been saying."
Yeah.
When I tell you these are, it's like 5 or 6 shots, and they're all bricks. And they're like the loudest bricks you'll hear. Like, these are nasty bricks. Yeah. You could build a house with these bricks. That's what I want to see. That's what I want to see Skip do.
It will be interesting. But that's all we have for time. Come back next week because we're going to be only 1 week away from the release of the chapter to hear our chapter 1112 predictions. And maybe this time we will actually find out what YouTubers I like to hate on. No promises on that last part. In the meantime, we are your friends who read One Piece. Help us get more friends by liking, sharing, giving us 5 stars, and keeping an eye out for our YouTube and TikTok, because apparently that's what the cool kids are into right now. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm. Later.
Bye.